Hi, Peter. How are you?
Charlie, I'm good. How are you?
Yes, very good. Thanks. Very good.
It's good to talk again, my man.
Yeah. I'm on the phone. I'm on my mobile. I'm in Sky Meadow. The children are at school. The dogs are in the house. But I should say that there is a pigeon scarer in the next field. So if there's a loud bang, I apologise in advance. That's what it is.
It's not a scene from Emmerdale Farm, Charlie. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Something like that. I'm really, really honoured to be on the Sod Show. Thank you so much for asking me on.
Yeah, well, you did pay me a lot of money, Charlie, in fairness.
You weren't meant to say that, Peter.
Sorry, okay. Hold on a second. We should do the intro music here, and I'll talk to you in a little bit. One sec, we play the tune. Do you want to intro the show, Charlie, instead, then?
Oh, okay. All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sod Show Garden Podcast.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, it's a Friday afternoon, and this is the Sod Show with Peter and Charlie, and we're talking gardening and books.
That's terrible, Charlie. You should never host a Sod Show. Really.
Listen, I'm much better with a pen than on a podium, so I'll leave the Sod Show to you if that's all right.
Well, most people would. Difference is you'll get paid for doing the book.
Hope so.
And I'll just get dog's abuse for doing the Sod Show. Let's get into it, Charlie. Why are we having a conversation that you're the special guest on this one? But for those who aren't aware, who is Charlie Hart?
Okay, so I'm a husband and a father first, I guess, and I am a gardener. Quite an enthusiastic one. I lived in London for 10 years, which I really didn't like. I always felt that living in a big city was a bit like stepping into the fuzzy white noise of an untuned TV. But 4 years ago, my wife and I made our escape, and we escaped to a little farmhouse in North Essex. And the little farmhouse had 5 acres of virgin meadowland, and I spied the opportunity to build an audacious garden, which I'm in the process of doing. But there were some rocky patches, and sadly, I lost both my parents. And I discovered how gardening really helped me with that whole process. And I then went and increasingly, you know, took to writing about gardens sort of semi-professionally, I guess. And I helped with a garden at Chelsea. I got to know some gardening editors. Occasionally, they asked me to write pieces. And one of them encouraged me to write a book. And that book is called Sky Meadow, and that's really why we're talking, I think.
Now, I know the answer to this in brackets, obviously, but who was the person who encouraged you to write the book?
So the person who encouraged me to write the book is Jane Perrone. And in fact, I might, if I can take the opportunity, the only podcast I listen to is your one and occasionally her one on the ledge. So you're my two favourite podcasts. And she is really, she was very kind to me. She sort of encouraged me to write, basically. I wasn't sure that I was able to or that people would ever want to read anything that I wrote. But she encouraged me and she started publishing the odd piece that I'd written. And then she encouraged me to actually man up and write a book, which is what I did.
Two things, Charlie, that you noted. One was virgin meadow land. What is that for those who are not aware, who haven't done the journey that you've done?
It is an area that hasn't been cultivated before, but it is not. I mean, it wasn't a wildflower meadow. It would have fallen into the category of pony paddock. Okay, so basically, I should probably just explain a little bit more about our home where we live, because it'll make more sense of it. So basically, there's a very long drive with 70-foot poplars along it, and the drive comes into the plot, and the plot is like a triangle, and it runs down the side of a valley. And as it runs down the valley, it widens up, and the sort of area immediately around the house was originally a little like Elizabethan farmlet. It's got a little pond and a barn and an orchard, all the bits you'd imagine from a little farm. And then at the bottom of that area, immediately around the house, is a great elm hedge. And when we first visited, I remember walking down and seeing this hedge and just sort of thinking, what on earth is behind that? And when I looked, I saw what some people might call a pony paddock, but to me was this incredibly romantic meadow that sort of on a misty day seems to float in the sky. And it's that's where I built this new garden.
Bring me a step further then. What is Peveril's Farm. Have I pronounced that correctly even?
You have. You've pronounced it perfectly. Peveril's Farm is a farmhouse with 7 acres. Originally, it was a proper working farm. But 100 years ago, the house and the land got separated. And now it is a crazy little farmhouse that sits at the top of the hill with an increasingly crazy garden that spreads down into the bottom of the valley.
And Sky Meadow Den is the book that you've written. That's the name on that one.
Yeah, it's called Sky Meadow, Notes from an English Gardener.
Now I've got that clarified in Peter's sometimes complex, shall I call it brain even, I don't know. We'll park all that to one side and let's try and get this. You then, from moving to London, you moved to this farm, which is Peveril's Farm. Was it your mom and dad's place? Did you move in there with your parents? How did that bit all work out?
Yeah, no, it wasn't actually. So basically, I grew up on a farm, not that far away from here, but not this farm. And my dad died and the farm got sold. And that's when I was living in London. And I felt I felt upset about it, obviously. And as I say, I've struggled with anxiety one way or another throughout my adult life. And I struggled particularly being in a city. But because the farm where I'd grown up had gone and my father had died, I struggled particularly. And in fact, I mean, I even found it quite hard taking the kids to the park. You know, now when I go to a city, I love a park because it's the best place to be in a big city. But at the time, it just sort of made me realize that I was living in London. I didn't want to. So we started looking to move and for a house. It was a bigger deal for my wife because she at the time had 3 kids in tow. But we started looking and we were going to live in Gloucestershire because that's where my wife's family come from. But we looked and looked and looked and couldn't find anything. And eventually, we found something we sort of liked in Gloucestershire and offered on it, but the vendor said we weren't offering enough. And I was so tired of the whole process, I just said, let's just get a bigger mortgage and offer more. But my wife said, just before we do, a farmhouse has come up in Essex, where your family come from, and I just think we should have a look at it. So we did, and the rest is history.
Let's get into the bit where it gets a bit difficult, Charlie. And you tell me when and if I've possibly crossed the line, but I gather there is... In fact, I know there is, but I gather there is a point where this actually trickles into the book ever so slightly.
Yeah.
How difficult from a, I'll pause here slightly, but for a male, number one, a man, and number two, an Irish male, they're the two genes that really should never be put into the one and people expect any logic to come out of. In every sense of the word. And there is a laughing joke in there, but at the same token, there is also a point where, on a serious note, when it comes to depression, when it comes to anxiety, when it comes to dealing with real world problems, I say problems, issues, they might be at a micro level from a home perspective or a family perspective. If that puts it in context for you listening at home, how difficult did that journey get for you, Charlie?
Well, no, I welcome the question. Look, as you say, I really don't think that people often just feel that they can't talk about this stuff. And that's, you know, a large part of the problem. And certainly I fitted into that category completely too. I mean, when I talk about anxiety, so I don't really mean worry, which is something we all are familiar with. And it's almost like a symptom that you can sort of ignore. I mean, trying to live a normal life when your brain chemistry is telling you that you're in mortal combat with a lion. That was a sort of, and there were times when it was very bad, actually. When my father died was not when it was at its worst. When he was really ill is when it was at its worst. So I, one of the things I hope this book does is I hope it will encourage people to talk honestly about anxiety. And as you say, I've never considered myself to be a depressive as such. I think there is a distinction between depression and anxiety, but I've certainly been brought very low by anxiety. And there were times when, you know, it sent me to my bed and I couldn't really get up and do anything. And then I gradually figured out a way of sort of turning an autopilot on so I could do normal stuff. And I looked outwardly like I was functioning normally, but inwardly I was in a sort of frozen stool. And one of the things that this garden has done for me, and it's one of the things I hope people can get a sense of from the book, is gardening has this amazing way of helping to heal people, and I really thoroughly believe that. And I think one of the mechanisms for it is that gardening forces you to look and to look really carefully at things. And it's about, in a sort of, it's taught me this sort of mysterious lesson that if you get the courage to look at things like grief and anxiety, it can really help in terms of the process of healing. And one of the things I say in my book is that for me, anxiety was always a bit like a harrow. So it's like being attached to a harrow. When I was a little kid, my dad used to let me go harrowing in the fields at home, and I'd whiz up and down the fields with this big harrow on a little tractor, feeling very grown up. And I had this amazing sense that something other than me was pulling this great weight of metal across the landscape. But for me, anxiety has always felt a bit like I'm attached to a harrow, and every jot and tittle of the land is like passing along the harrow through the chains to my head. And of course, that's a lie. Of course, it's not true. But that's, I think, what anxiety does. And what I discovered through gardening, through working with the seasons, through the lost and gained harvest, is that it's when you try and run away from the harrow that the chains grimly tighten. But when you move towards the harrow, they get looser. And I know this is a bit obscure and it's a bit out there, but it's something that I feel my garden has taught me, and it's certainly helped me in my recovery.
The synopsis that Waterstones have on your book, Charlie, notes that in Sky Meadow, Charlie seamlessly weaves together his own memoir. Memoir, that's quite difficult with an Irish accent, with that of his garden. The result is a lyrical and incisive story of mental health at an all-time low. We would have had Ian Price on the show prior to building his garden at Chelsea 2017, I believe it was, and yeah. Ian talks very much in depth about mental health and his own struggles with that, and we'll park that one there. And for those of you listening at home, when this interview is done, go back and listen. Part 2 and particular is the one that you're aiming for. It'll be in your iTunes provider. How of an all-time low, Charlie, was that?
Well, it's difficult because it's subjective, but it was really tough. So the first 18 months we got out here, I sound silly this, but my wife didn't have a, so we moved to a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. I mean, our nearest neighbour is half a mile away, and my wife didn't have a driving licence. And we thought, oh, it's going to be easy. She'll get a driving licence, you know, not a problem. But actually, we didn't reckon on the fact that she's a dyspraxic. So we thought it would take a couple of months. It took 18 months. And then she became pregnant again. She had a low-lying placenta, which was a sort of, it's not a major issue, but it means that I had to do a lot of the looking after the kids and stuff. And then my mum died, following on from my father dying. So it was a very low, very, very difficult period. I was massively supported by my family and the garden. I got up to go to the garden, and there were times when that's all I could do.
I know this is a podcast, and we try and do the happy sunshine escapism from other things that go on, other what I would call noise. If it's not a chirp and it's got wings, I pretty much don't want to hear it. My TV is not connected. I like a pint of Guinness. I like very good whiskey. We all have bits of falls in life, but let me take this another angle with you, Charlie, because you move from what I will call the big smoke to the countryside. There's a Dylan Moore and joke in there where, actually, hold on.
You might get this notion that there's a better life for you elsewhere, because that's what happens to people. They get stressed out somewhere like this. They think, you know, we should, I don't know, go to the country somewhere shire. It's a very bad idea. I grew up in the country. You don't want to go there. You've got everything here. You're not going to realize your dreams somewhere else. You can do it all here. You can be trapped in traffic in Tufnell Park for 20 years and you'll never have that experience anywhere else. You don't want to go to the country anyway. Most of you know nothing about it. You talk about it all the time. You read about it in Sunday supplements. You're never going to go. Why would you go? There's nothing there. Farmers aren't really people. You know this. They're just necessary. We need somebody to kill cows. Give me a cappuccino before I pass out. I need a mugger. I need to have a healthy injection of cynicism right now. People say, I'm going to go, it'll be great. We'll have a solar panel toilet. We'll get the whole family thatched. Rubbish. And then you get these articles about how unhealthy modern life is in a city. You know, you get, you're sophisticated people. You meet up every 9 months to have a coffee with somebody and bitch about your best friend who's not there. I hate them. I hate them more than you do. Here they come. Hi, how are you?
that joke parked firmly to one side. When you go, when you move to this piece of land, I'm reminded of when I first went out on my own in business, Charlie, and people say to me, oh my God, it must be great. You get to build gardens under your own name. You're Peter Donegan, you're Donegan Landscaping. But at the same token, there's a reality here, Charlie, where you've got bills to pay. So getting up in the morning or not getting up in the morning and doing some work in the garden, how are you funding all of this? Because let's be frank about it, irrespective of whether you had other, I'll call them ancillary issues just for the minute, and I apologize on the use of those words, but being one of eight children, being reared through 1980s in Ireland when things weren't great in any sense of the word, the greatest cause of argument that I ever witnessed, maybe, no disrespect to my folks, was there essentially wasn't enough money to do all of the things that one needed to do, not what one wanted to do, one needed to do. In short, writing books and digging the ground and being at one with nature is not financially rewarding. Does that make sense with you?
It makes a huge amount of sense to me. And the reality is, when we left London, you know, we had some savings, that was good. My wife was keen that I should carry on naturally and understandably working, you know, on that sort of, not on a nice city trajectory, let's say. But I knew I had to change. I knew I had to pursue this gardening thing, and I was finding within it a lot of solutions to personal issues. So, but I still have to do the maths, and I still have to pay the bills. What happened basically is I did get a bit of a break, which was really helpful. So, and it's funny, it's a funny story. So obviously my wife and I were talking about it, going backwards and forwards about whether I should do it. And one evening we were having one of those like husband and wife chats. It was sort of 3 o'clock in the morning, a couple of glasses of wine. And she said, listen, Charlie, I've been thinking about this. I think, you know, you don't want to have any regrets. You don't want to get to 80 and then wish you'd done something else. So she said, I think you've just got to go for this gardening thing. And I thought I had a pink ticket. You know, it was amazing. And I went to bed. I sent a couple up and just sort of prayed, you know, look, if this is right, can something happen and happen soon? That means that. And it's the weirdest thing. The very next day, I got a phone call from a friend of mine who, when I lived in London, I'd worked a little bit on lobbying to bring in a new law to end modern slavery. And I got a phone call from a friend of mine who I knew from that period, who also knew I was a mad keen gardener. And she said, look, Charlie, with a couple of other mates, we're going to take a garden for Chelsea Flower Show to raise awareness of modern slavery. And I know you interviewed Juliet Sargent, the brilliant and amazing garden designer for that garden previously. But my friend said, look, we're going to do it and we'd really love you to be the campaign director. And so basically and that was the next day after my chat with my wife, Sibylla. So I said, yeah, no, amazing. And off I trotted to do it. And the great thing about that was that I got to meet quite a few gardening editors and people started to ask me to write. So writing about gardens is not an easy road to riches. But what I will say is that the sum started, at least, if not to reverse, to improve. And it's risky and you know, it's not always entirely comfortable.
Let's get down to brass tacks. What is the income? What makes you your living now, Charlie?
Well, writing about gardens and hanging on in there, hoping that over time that number gets bigger and bigger and more sustainable. Having said that, one of the arguments, obviously, one of the reasons why I justified this in my own mind was that I could hopefully write about gardens, but we are hoping that we might even open the garden at some point. There's some logistical issues with that, and there's some other things, but it may happen in the next short period, and that would be another like angle. But I mean, I think you've got to do everything you can, really.
To be honest with you, Charlie, that's the answer I was hoping that you would give me, because the amount of people I know who literally do that Dylan Moran joke that you would have heard, you know, it's going to be great, we'll be living the dream, and then all of a sudden the realities kick in and you realise...
Yeah, like last week, I had to have a new septic tank fitted, and they had to, we had to run a pipe all the way from the septic tank down to the bottom of the meadow. I mean, it was nose-bleedingly expensive. But you know, you push on, you live on, and you write as furiously as you can. And the nice thing is, people do buy words. I mean, I'm flabbergasted. I'm bowled over every time someone pays me for some words. But thank God, it does happen. So you know, I just push on and hope for the best, really. And juggle when necessary.
What did you do when you were living in London, Charlie? What's your education, your own personal background?
Okay, so I went to Cambridge University. I read theology. I then went to London because I thought I should. I did lots of, I set up businesses. I was entrepreneurial. I set up lots of different businesses. And I had this weird thing where every business I set up was successful within 6 months and paying me a reasonable salary. And just at the point where it was going to be really successful publicly in some way or another, you know, in the sort of way that people would say, oh, look, that's a good business. I left it and did something else. And I think the reason was because I was stupidly hoping that I might make enough money to escape the country. So I was sort of trying to set myself up in one way of life only to then abandon it. And it just didn't work. And it left me feeling very dissatisfied. And it was actually, you know, I still feel guilty to this day. My poor wife is very long suffering. So I worked lots of things. I set up a business in PR. I set up a business in like commercial real estate. I mean, all sorts of things.
You mentioned the words escape to the country. That is, in fact, a television program, Charlie. You do know that.
I'm not referencing the TV program. I'm referencing my mad dash to the country that I felt compelled to make.
How long are you now there, Charlie?
So we've been here for 4 years. We're going into our sort of fifth growing season.
In reality, Charlie, when we went on holidays in 1982 to somewhere in the middle of nowhere, essentially a bad field, and it rained non-stop for one weekend, and there's six kids screaming, crying, and the sandwiches are wet, the socks are wet, the shoes are wet, the tent is leaking. Pause. You fast track forward about 20 years and you look back and you say, weren't they good times? And then you actually get back to that as a grown adult with your own children and you say, God, that was a disastrous holiday. Hindsight may change the perception with a couple of glasses of wine, but in reality, it's torrid. It's horrible. Nobody should ever go there on holidays, especially not when it's raining or even when it's sunny for that matter. When you look at where you are now at this minute in time, the journey that you started, how has that journey been, and have the water settled?
Well, it's so interesting you use those metaphors because basically when we moved out of London, I got a genuinely small check from my grandmother, and I didn't know what to spend it on, and I thought I might, you know, my friend of mine said there was a sale coming up at Bonhams and it had East Anglian art in it, and since we were going to East Anglia, he said you should have a look. I said, no way, I don't have enough money for it. But he said, no, it's a, like a low price sale or whatever. So I looked and I found a picture of a ship off the coast of Ipswich straining on the sea, and it was an empty room. I bid on it, agreed a like total amount with Sibylla, bid on it, and we got it. And when I took it back, I remember thinking that ship straining on the sea might in some way represent what we were about to do. I just had this dim sense that it might get choppy. And it did get choppy, really choppy. But I would say from when people started asking me to write for them and when things sort of worked out, impersonally speaking, which was about, let's say, a year and a half ago, something like that, I got that picture and I hung it on the staircase in the house. There's a sort of big beam as thick as a bull's neck, which sort of guards the way up to the top floor where we go and sleep. And I hung the picture there, and I hung it there to remind myself that actually, when things are going better, it's as well to remember that it wasn't always like that. And I'd say I would have to bring the personal stuff back into this in a way, because really building this garden, it's been a bit like as the gardens come together on an incoming tide, my grief has sort of gone out on an ebbing one. And there was a moment, not this spring, the spring before, where I was sitting in the house and a robin chirped and I picked up my spade and I went and dug. Because I found digging very, very therapeutic. And it's partly the endorphins, but it's more than that. It's having your hands in the soil. And this particular morning, it was around the anniversary of both of my parents' death. And the robin chirped, and I picked up my spade, and I went and dug, and I realized I was digging for pleasure, but not out of pain anymore. And that was a really important moment. And that was the moment when I took this picture and I put it above the stairs. And that was about a year and a half ago, I guess. So that's some sort of an answer, perhaps, to your question.
It's probably the same answer that I would give you, except for the picture might be slightly different, to be quite fair to you, Charlie. So it makes a lot more sense than you realise. Charlie, what's spare time for you? What do you do when you're not digging in the garden or writing for the many publications that you do write for?
Well, I don't have a huge amount of spare time because we've just got, our kids are all still quite young. So there's masses of school runs left, right and centre, and there's homework to be done with them, which I don't particularly enjoy, but I try to smile. And there's all that side of things. I mean, I love reading, so I read a lot if I get any spare time. But I don't have a huge amount of spare time. I mean, I squeeze every bit of daylight at this time of year out. Every spare bit I get is really in the garden. I don't have any help in the garden at all. It's just me, and I've got over a mile of hedges to cut every year. So, you know, I basically, that is my spare time for now, I'm afraid. Oh, I watch telly in the evenings occasionally, pass out in the armchair with my wife, you know, watching something or another. But I don't have any spare time.
Who said romance is dead, Charlie? Who said romance is dead, huh?
That's the truth.
Yeah. Right. Pop quiz round, Charlie. Have you got a favourite soccer team?
I know absolutely nothing about football. My son Isaac is a pro. He is teaching me about it. Because of him, I support Arsenal. And we haven't talked. But I don't know what that means particularly. I was never good at sports at school. I was always a bit, anyway. But he's thankfully much, much more normal, and he loves Arsenal. So I support Arsenal, and we haven't talked so much about the structure of the garden, but actually he has a quarter size football pitch in Sky Meadow. And so he's got me going on football, but I'm afraid I'm a Luddite when it comes to sport.
How far away is your local pub, Charlie, and do you go there?
I do go there, and it is about just under half a mile.
What's your local tipple, or what do you drink when you're at the bar?
If I'm in the pub, I'll have a beer probably, or if I'm eating something, maybe a glass of wine, but I love whiskey. That's my favourite tipple. And so long as it, you know, not too much, and I put some water in with it, but I do love whiskey. And in fact, I have a bottle of Jameson's Irish whiskey on the go at the moment, which my mother-in-law gave me for Christmas.
I'm warming to your mother, Charlie. I'm warming. I have to say, no. That's, if you were a woman, Charlie, all I'm saying is the Arsenal thing tied in there with the bottle of Irish whiskey, we would be already halfway up the aisle. You do understand that.
What a charming thought, Peter.
Charlie, if people want to get in touch, I gather you're on all of the social media things that might be required.
Yes, I do. I tweet at Peveril's Gardens, and I do the Instagram thing, which I think is Heart Gardener, and I do all that sort of stuff. And of course, any commissioning editors are very welcome to get in touch.
For those of you actually on the road, whether you're in Salt Lake City, if you're in Dublin, or if you're in London strolling around, you're listening to this and you need any of Charlie's contact details, just send us a note at Sodshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSodshow and Sodshow.com. Sky Meadow, Notes from an English Gardener. It's in hardback and it's just been released. In fact, today, the day of this airing, it's available in all good bookstores. And if they don't have it, because you're the type of people who you like to support local, we're on it. A similar page, and you go in there and you say, hey, order this book for me, and they will do that for you. There's also the online if you're not near a bookshop, but at the same token, go in and ask them. They probably do that signed copy thing like I got. In the meantime, Charlie Hart, it has been an absolute pleasure, my good man, to talk to you. I look forward to visiting your garden when it opens, and I look forward when we do that to cracking open, or finishing off, polishing off, as my dad would have called it, the bottle of Jameson.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me too.
And for you listening at home, thank you so much for listening. To know that you're there, we're partway through April right now. The sun has come out. It may be raining the day I say this, or the day you choose to listen to this, but it's good to have you by my side. It's good to know that you're listening, but make no bones about it. It's also nice when you get a story on the Sideshow, which is like everything, whether it's building a show garden, and we're talking to Kate Gold, and she's saying in 2017 about how there was the financial thing in there, and there was a bit of a dip and a lull, whether it's Paul Hervey Brooks or just Peter on a random Tuesday. There's an upshot in here, and there's a positive, and there's a rainbow essentially at the end of that journey. Charlie Hart's book, Sky Meadow, is available as we speak now. Thank you so much for listening. All have a great weekend in the great outdoors. Charlie, it's been a pleasure, my good man.
Thank you so much, Peter. It really has been a joy.
Excellent. We'll chat soon.
Yeah, cool. Look forward to it. Bye.
Bye.